to bring this meeting of House Resources to order. It is Friday, January 27th, and it's approximately 1:05 p.m. And present is Representative Wilson, Representative Herron, Representative Dick, Representative Foster, Representative Munoz, Co-Chair Feige, and myself, Co-Chair Seaton. I want to remind everybody about their cell phones, and then also remind people to address their questions through the chair. And if we have more than one person at the table testifying and there's a question, would you please say your first name for the recording secretary anyway, as before you answer that question? Because if we have two women there, the secretary is, then we're trying to remember, well, who was it that said that? So it's just for that. You'll need to identify yourself on the record first before you start. But through the testimony, if there's more than one person, if it's a single testifier, you don't need to do that. And want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Kawasaki. And so today, you know, we are looking at renewable energy projects, and we are looking at those from the overview of trying to figure out where, what status different projects are doing, what potential project developers are seeing for their projects, any glitches that they see as the, you know, changing timelines that have been previously presented to the legislature. So this is an overview. It's, we don't have a bill before us. We don't have a budgetary item before us. What we're trying to do is the Resource Committee get a handle on renewable energy throughout the state of Alaska, and particularly projects that the legislature has been interested in or funding. So we have a number of folks to present, and I'm just going to read those down so that people online will know. And the Juneau International Airport, talking about their ground source heat pump, Alaska Sea Life Center, the seawater heat transfer technology, Ormat, talking about the geothermal project on Mount Spur on the west side of Cook Inlet, Naknek Electric on their geothermal project out in Naknek, Kodiak Electric on Pillar Mountain Wind Project, Siri on Fire Island Wind, Ocean Renewable Power Company on their Cook Inlet Tidal Power Project, and Aetna Inc., which is looking at the geothermal potential in the Copper River Basin and around Glen Allen. So I want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Gardner. And so we will start with the Juneau International Airport, and I believe we have Catherine Fritz. Are you there?
Yes.
And if you have someone else to present with you, that's fine. You can both go to the table.
How do we do this?
I'll just sort of rearrange the chairs, and just make sure that when you testify that you don't have to have a real close, you know, you can be 8-10 inches away from the mic, it's fine, but just make sure it's pointed in your direction.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jeannie Johnson. I'm the manager of the Juneau International Airport, a municipal airport here in Juneau, and I really appreciate the opportunity for us to come and present to you. I think you're going to hear some very exciting news about how we've used state dollars that we got and have been successful with them. So I'd like to introduce Catherine Fritz. This is our airport architect, and this is Doug Murray of Murray & Associates. And Doug was the designer on the project, and Catherine was the project manager. So I'll turn it over to them. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Catherine Fritz, and I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon. We have a brief PowerPoint that we'd like to run through quickly. We hope it'll give you an overview of our project, and we're certainly available to answer any questions. We started the Juneau Airport terminal renovation with three primary goals: reducing our operating costs, modernizing our infrastructure, and improving passenger experiences through the airport. We had a $50 million scope of work, and we had about $23 million to deal with it. So that's what got us interested in looking at alternatives. We took the approach that we were going to do it in two phases. We were going to renovate and add on any parts of the building that were 1984, and then the newer add-on from that. And then eventually phase two would entail replacement of pre-1984 portions of the building that actually date back to 1948, the original terminal. Our three approaches were that we were going to address having excellent design, that really good design would be better than having lots of design. We were going to be efficient in everything we did, from the design decisions we made to the operations. We were going to consider all aspects of our project holistically for operating, maintaining every square foot that we would renovate or add on. We were going to be modern in our facility in terms of bringing it up aesthetically, making it an exciting place to be, something that responded to travelers' expectations in the 21st century. And we were going to design and construct to a high-performance standard. Now, that's a term that the U.S. Department of Energy established many years ago, which basically means that the insulation value of the envelope of the building, the way that windows are selected, the mechanical systems are selected, everything about the infrastructure of the building itself is done in a high-performance way. In other words, it's very efficient. I wanted to share a bit about the geothermal heat system basics that we used on this project, because I think there's a lot of some people are just kind of afraid to ask, can you give me the basics of how does this thing work? And so I thought I'd do a quick overview of that. The concept is that we put pipes into the ground that are filled with fluid. Our pipes are vertical. They go about 350 feet deep. The concept is that you'll use liquid going through these pipes to heat the fluid, or to capture the heat of the earth more correctly, by having them in the ground at a ground temperature that for us is around 42 degrees. That then that fluid is pumped into the building through an extensive piping system that goes to every single one of the heat pumps themselves. And in each heat pump, water goes in and air comes out. Much like your refrigerator operates at home, cold air is inside that box, but it's in an environment of warm air. We work conversely most of the time in ours, though it's heating most of the time, not cooling. We sought Alaska Energy Authority grant funding. Our request was part of the 2008 program for alternative energy and the construction funding request. We prepared the application ourselves, and I just point this out because I really want to give credit to the way that that program was designed in terms of it was very easy to follow the rules, put in the application, do what AEA was asking for. The documents were very reasonable. We didn't hire any, you know, outside special grant writer. We just followed the instructions and submitted the application, and we were very pleased to be a grant awardee in October of 2008. So construction of our system itself, it began outside in the ground. We took a section of the airfield where the small planes are parked right now, and we set it aside, and we constructed this loop field. And that's where we drilled these 108 borings. They're 6-inch borings, holes that were drilled 350 feet deep into the earth. Inside each of those vertical holes runs two pipes, one that goes down, and then at the bottom is a U assembly, so it continuously then heads up. And then near the top, about 8 or 9 feet buried from the surface of the ground, they all join together. And it constitutes about 16 miles of piping in the ground, and it captures that earth temperature of about 42 degrees. The pipes themselves, it's common to ask, well, how can we be assured that these pipes aren't going to fall apart, or what happens if they break? You know, it's going to be a serious trouble if we've got a pipe leak somewhere. It's a process called pipe fusion that's actually been technology that the state of Alaska has used for a long time, particularly in the mining industry. The idea that you can join these two pipes, the specialized HDPE, which is a chemical type of plastic, which Doug could give you more of the detail on. But anyway, the idea is that when these are welded, when they are fused together, they are actually stronger than when in their initial state. It's kind of like how the doctor explains to you that after you've broken a bone, when it heals, it's stronger. The pipe has a long life expectancy, and manufacturers will readily say in excess of 100 years. Once those pipes go into the building, there are a series of two groups of pipes that go into the building. All of the field work is consolidated into four main lines that go into the building, and four lower and four upper, because they go into the building, then they come out again. That liquid goes in. The fluid itself is about 88% water and 12% methanol, which is an antifreeze material, environmentally safe material that can be used. It continually circulates through the building to those heat pumps that I mentioned earlier. There's a critical three-way valve that helps decide, helps the, that's all electronically, digitally controlled, that helps the system decide whether it loops just inside the building or whether there's a need for it to go back out to the airfield, back into the loop itself to go and gain more heat or cooling from the outside earth. It's really fascinating to us right now to see how much of the year the building is operating more or less on its own without having to go back out and recharge to the field. So there's some interesting things we're learning about the system. Once we're in the ceilings, that's where you find the heat pumps themselves at the airport. Sometimes these are consolidated in rooms. We chose the ceiling. There's pros and cons to that. It's a design decision based on a lot of different parameters, but we have 28 of them in the ceiling. And they are about the size of a small refrigerator. So there are these black boxes that are up above the ceiling tiles, and our maintenance people can get to those by removing tiles and doing the filter changes and the maintenance that's needed on them continually. Now we have three other heat pumps, and they're called water-to-water heat pumps or water source heat pumps. And they provide the heat, the energy, to our ice melt system out on our sidewalk. So I hope you've had the pleasure of being able to come into the Juneau Airport and not be stumbling over ice and snow and from getting from the taxi area to the building, because it's now a totally thawed, dry, concrete area for the winter, which is a huge benefit to our passengers, our public, and everybody who comes and goes to the airport. This does come at a cost. This is not free energy, but the fact that we were able to use this on a geothermal and electric heat pump system made this cost effective. Had we used traditional technology with diesel, we would not have been able to afford to operate such a system. So our performance to date, how are we doing? 2008 was really the year prior to any installation of any heat pumps, and so we have to go back to really look at how much diesel was being used in the building at that time. And you see from the figures it was about a little over 89,000 gallons at that point. That has reduced to about 52,000 gallons in 2011. Now, we just really became fully operating and balanced and all systems going in May of 2011. So we want to be cautious in giving this data because it's a very superficial type, preliminary type analysis. But the basic numbers are a decrease in diesel with an average cost of around $3.52 a gallon during that period to around $130,000 that we've saved. However, we've increased electrical usage because these are electric heat pumps, but not at nearly the rate of what it costs to operate diesel. So our increase between the period of 2008 and 2011 is about 15,000 for a net direct fuel usage annual savings of about 115,000. Additional benefits. I already mentioned the snow and ice operations benefit. We're actually saving about $11,000 a year, not having our staff out throwing chemical on the concrete and plowing snow and that type of thing in the front of the terminal. By removing the central heating and ventilating equipment that we had under a traditional system, it has freed up valuable square footage in our airport that we're using for other things. In fact, what used to be our old air handling room is now the TSA screening area. So we were able to take all of those security screening operations and put them in the mechanical room, in essence. So it's been a tremendous benefit to allow that square footage to be used for other functions of the airport. The heat pumps provide improved air quality, including air conditioning, so we get heating, cooling, and ventilation in every space in the airport, which we would not have been able to have because we couldn't have afforded it in a previous application. We have sized that loop field out there in under the 135 carrier, the small plane area, to address our need to replace the pre-1984 sections of the building. So when we get ready to replace that those remaining parts of the building, we figure we're about half done with the terminal renovation at this point, and we've just started the preliminary planning for that other replacement, we won't have to go out and dig another loop field. We have, however, also provided for us to be able to add onto it in the future if we determine that we did need more size of the loop field. So the fact is that it is there to serve our needs for a good long time. The reduction in diesel usage has also contributed to a carbon emissions reduction, and we don't have the specific calculations of that, but we know it's helping. And mostly, the confidence that we've gained through this installation has really convinced us that geothermal technology is really a good consideration for the heating, cooling, and ventilating needs for facilities at the airport, and in fact, we are using the same technology as we begin to construct the new snow removal equipment building at the airport. The last thing I wanted to leave you with is the idea that the geothermal heat pumps are in themselves a nice entity that have been able to let us convert from diesel to a renewable hydroelectric source. But they're not all, they are dependent on another aspect of it, and that's a holistic approach to the entire building is taken. If we would have just taken the old 1984 sections of the building and not upgraded the windows, not upgraded the insulation, not replaced lighting and other outdated equipment, we would not see the savings that we have, and we don't think we would be making the good long-term decision for investment in the structure. So it really takes looking at new standards, like the new standards we have under this high-performance design idea these days of insulation underneath slabs, which we didn't have in Juneau prior to the last 10 years ago, for example, heavy vapor barriers, insulation on the outside of the building as well as in the wall system itself, and really high-quality glazing. So it's really part of a holistic system when you're talking about buildings. So thank you very much. The grant funding made a huge, huge difference for us, and in fact, I think it is what, I personally believe it was what made the airport decide that we were going to go with this technology and try this. And so far, we are very, very pleased with how it's performed for us and very excited about the applications it might have in the future.
Great. Thank you. We have Representative Feige and then Representative Wilson.
A couple of questions. Your saving is about $114,000 a year. That's obviously dependent on cost of diesel and cost of electricity, but what's your payback period on the project?
This is Catherine, and through the chair. Those paybacks, I mean, again, that $115,000 is a direct fuel usage cost. What we have not gone into detail with is calculating all of the other aspects of electricity that have contributed to that same figure. So all we did was take gross electric and gross diesel. I think when we originally, I'm going to need Doug's help on what the original payback was, 10 years? Mm-hmm. It was 10 years in the feasibility report. And with the $115,000 a year, it was about $1 million more that it cost total to do this technology rather than a good new electric boiler system. That wasn't diesel. Diesel would have been even more. But when we did our feasibility analysis, we said if we put in a new electric boiler, or we go geothermal, what's the delta? What's the difference there? And that's what we applied for grant funding based on. And that, so that was like a 10-year payback. So we have met that expectation, and we actually have exceeded that.
Okay, and then
Feige.
I guess there's a couple of key variables in the design of the system is the ground temperature, the cost of the diesel, and the cost of the electric to run it, but, and then, of course, the temperature, the climate of wherever you're installing one of these. So obviously it seems to work well here in Juneau, but speaking for my district, you have a very mild climate here. So at what, where in Alaska is something like this going to be useful, and what are the break-even points as far as the temperature and location where you could actually install one of these things and get it to work?
Mr. Chair, I'd prefer that our engineer, Doug Murray, speak to that.
Okay.
So I think he could.
Sure. And if you are just familiar with the Juneau project and don't know those factors across the other state, you can respond that way.
You bet. Thank you. This is Doug, to the chair, the co-chair. It really depends on the building, and it depends on the location. You know, if you have a building with a real low heat requirement, then you might be able to do something in a higher latitude a community. I know that they've looked at it in several locations in Anchorage, and there's even some geothermal applications in Fairbanks on the Fort Wainwright base. So it really depends on your application. So it's building specific as well as location specific. Really, when the ground temperature goes down, essentially what you're doing is your coefficient of performance or your efficiency of the system goes down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it really depends on the building itself. So I didn't answer your question, but I did it on purpose because it really depends on on that. And so an analysis needs to be done of that particular building.
Okay. And I might just mention as we go along here that there are geothermal residences being built in Homer, Alaska. So So although it's further north, it does, you know, I'm not sure exactly what those temperatures are, but they found that they are very cost competitive, saving a lot of money for people in those residents.
Another mild climate.
Yes, yeah, right. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, because when you did this, you also you put in new windows, I mean, you know, and so you really can't say that the savings was 100% from that, from the geothermal, because you got in better insulation, better better windows, probably better insulation in the roof even and whatnot. So is there any way that you can divide any of that at all?
Mr. Chair, this is Catherine. You're absolutely right, and those are the variables that I referred to. Fundamentally, we added 12,000 square feet to this building. So we added 12,000 square feet of usable building and increased our operating costs by only, or we still saved, sorry, our overall $115,000 a year. So, but that is the specific analysis that we have not done to see what exactly could we attribute to better insulation. What could we, the other challenge we have at the airport is it's all open space from that old 1948 construction right on through to the brand new 2010 construction. So we don't have like a wall that separates the two of them that you can say this operates on the old boilers still and it's very inefficient and cold, but over here we have new stuff. So there's a lot of more study that needs to be done.
Thank you.
And then we were going to Representative Kawasaki, and then was there another?
Yeah, part of my question was already answered earlier when we talked about the 10-year payback, but have you, do you have any experience about, this is all fairly new construction with the new facility upgrade, but how about old, renovating old facilities? You know, Fairbanks, of course, just had its airport renewed, I think 2005 was when it was finally finished, but can you talk to that?
This is Catherine, and the we did a combination of renovation and new. We did more renovation space. I believe the numbers were about 35,000 square feet of renovation and 12,000 square feet of new. So I think that's about right, isn't it, Doug? Yeah. So it definitely is effective with renovation. The key, as I mentioned earlier, is it's not just a conversion of one fuel type to another. You have to take a holistic approach to the entire building, and as Doug mentioned, it's very individualized. It's going to vary greatly to find out whether or not it is cost-effective. How feasible is it really, depending on the very specific application? We did a feasibility study. We were in this enough because, remember, we had those three primary goals in the beginning of trying to determine how were we going to control our operating costs, serve our passengers better, and overall improve the operations of the airport. And we knew we had to find things. We were already searching. And so in that search, we did a feasibility study prior to applying for the grant. So that's what started to get us thinking about alternatives firsthand.
Thank you. And Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. It's great to see both, all three of you. Could you tell me, does the bonding authority on the first phase extend to the second phase of the project, or will we go back and get further bonding authority? And what is your timeline for the second phase?
Mr. Chair, this, I can speak to that in part, and then I think I'll turn it to Jeannie. But this project overall, the renovation, was paid for in a rather unique way. As a municipal facility, we had a huge challenge in terms of even finding the $23 million that was our initial phase one budget, which, again, half of what we really need at the airport. And it was done with about $10 million in sales tax, local sales tax, about $8.5 million in passenger facility charges, PFCs, the fees that are brought off each passenger to the airport through an FAA program, $2.3 million in state funding altogether, some specific legislative appropriations, as well as the $513,000 Energy Authority grant, and some miscellaneous local funds. But primarily PFC's sales tax and a chunk of state money paid for that. So we don't have bonded indebtedness on this project. That's the other beauty of what you've, the pictures you saw and everything out there, it's paid for. The PFCs are collected over a period of time, and we have committed a collection period for a couple more years before phase one is paid for. Now, as for phase two, I'll let our airport manager speak to that.
Phase two, this is Jeannie, through the chair. We're in the planning stages of phase two. We're hoping to get another 1% of that Juneau sales tax when it goes to vote again. We'll probably try and get PFCs to make up the difference there. And who knows? I mean, if the state is generous enough, we may come back. But I don't believe that we're going to need any more energy money because we did plan ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the presentation and would like to note that the $114 million, if you just consider the amount that the state grant was, that's a repayment of 5 years. And so that's a, you know, not total project, but the state contribution. So we are now going to go to the next presentation, and thank you very much. And we're going to change the order just a little bit because there are some conflicts in other meetings. And so we're going to take Ormat. Format ready to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Ormat. Speaking is Paul Thompson, and joining me today on the phone is our Chief Geologist, Patrick Walsh, and our Project Manager, Rom Ornstein. And in the interest of time, we don't want to present our entire slide deck to you, but we really want to start our focus on slide 11. Okay. And so if the committee wants to jump to slide 11, we'll start there. I would just like to remind you that we're a publicly traded company, so any forward-looking statements we make, please consider them a prospectus at this time. Most of you are aware of Ormat and our experience in developing geothermal projects and our history in Alaska. In 2008, we acquired 36,000 acres of state lands under lease for the development of the Mount Spur project. In the summer of 2009, in 2010, we did some non-intrusive exploration work, and we started drilling on the project site actually in September of 2010. We drilled two exploration core holes, each to about 1,000 feet in depth, and in the summer of 2011, we drilled one deep exploration core hole to approximately 4,000 feet. If you turn to slide 12, we basically have what you're looking at is a overview of our lease area. And we've broken it into kind of three regions, if you will, the western region, the central region, and the eastern region. Moving to slide 13, this is our geological map of that of the previous map you were looking at. And if you look at drill site 2611, that is where we drilled our first hole. First deep well, excuse me. It's outside of the known volcanic hazardous zone, and it was in the eastern region. We were looking for a site that was less hazardous and safer, and we drilled along this Kidd Fault that you see on slide 13. If you, well, our future work, we're going to get to the results of this well in just a minute, but we're looking to move to the central part of our leasehold along the Crater Fault, where we think we are going to find more geothermal resource, but we have to do some analysis and satisfy some factors before we can start drilling there. So if we move to slide 14, you can see some pictures of us drilling in 2010 and 2011. Slide 15 shows you the core, the drilling core that we donated to the Department of Natural Resources and the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And slide 16 is really the heart of our presentation today to give you the updates. The results from the exploration work were encouraging that there's a potential geothermal resource at commercial depths. However, we don't think we're going to be able to find it economically in the eastern region, but we're going to start looking in that central region from that map on page 13. Like I said, the current geological model predicts a low likelihood in the eastern region, and so for that central region, we really have three criteria that we have to fulfill before we can start work again. And if you turn to page or slide 17, you'll see that we are trying to analyze the volcanic hazard at this site and can it be mitigated. And access And of course, looking at drilling again to find if there is a commercial resource at this site. What does this all mean? We really have pushed back our timeline by probably 2 years, and are looking to do this analysis this summer and start re-drilling again in 2013. If I can get you to turn to slide 21, you'll know that we thank all of you, in fiscal year 2012, we received a direct appropriation for about $14.5 million for work to begin in 2012, and we are going to look for support or see if we can utilize that funding in 2013 due to the change in our project scope at this time. So with that, that is the most current update from our Mount Spur project, and in the essence of time, I'd like to turn it over for questions. And as I said, we have our chief geologist and our project development manager here to answer any questions the committee might have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I had one, I understand that locating the geothermal resource and permeability and all that, under, you know, when you're talking about thousands of feet down underneath is difficult. Currently, Apache oil company is over there doing 3D seismic on the west side of Cook Inlet. Is 3D seismic something that is valuable in identifying the underlying structure and geothermal resource for a development like Ormat?
Yes, this is Patrick Walsh, the chief geologist for Ormat, and to Chairman Seaton. 3D seismic is extremely valuable in general in exploration for both oil and gas and for geothermal. However, it's also very challenging to collect in areas with great topographic relief. So this area of Mount Spur, it would be probably almost impossible because of the glaciers and high relief topography to collect a survey. So the Apache's work is down, I believe, down in the lower parts with either where it's water or low relief. So it's not a tool that we feel that we can use here. We do use it in several other locations. I'm currently looking at surveys in Southern California, among other places. And so it is something we use, but we don't think we can use it on Mount Spur primarily because of the extreme relief and glaciers that would bar collecting the data.
I presume you're familiar with their small nodes and the new technology that they're using for the entire Cook Inlet Basin. But if not, you might get in contact with them because they are doing their drills for their charges, and it just takes these small phones that are dropped over, no P lines, no wires. It's all wireless satellite connection now. So there may be some opportunity for you to dovetail with some of their work. So anyway, just wanted to
make
sure you were aware.
I will look at that. Thank you very much.
That they're doing that, this winter. So do we have other questions for Ormat? We are very excited about seeing this. We're happy to see that the lease went forward for investigation of geothermal resource. We're disappointed, as I'm sure you are, that conglomerate is not a very good where on that eastern side, but we'll look forward to your reports in the future, and thanks as we proceed forward looking for renewable resources. So are there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And now we have the Alaska Sea Life Center.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tara Jones. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Sea Life Center. I have here with me today Daryl Schaefermeyer, our operations manager, and we're very pleased to be here today to talk to you about our seawater heat pump project.
And just for the committee, that should have been under kind of the tab two. one back from where we were. Go ahead.
Hopefully most of you have been to the Sea Life Center, but if you're not, I would like to invite you to definitely come visit us. Our mission is to generate and share scientific knowledge to promote understanding and stewardship of Alaska's marine ecosystems. And our main programs are research, education, stranding, which is also known as a rescue and rehabilitation program, and of course our visitor exhibits. The center is a big economic driver in Seward and the Kenai Peninsula. Our annual payroll is over $4.5 million. We have about 90 year-round employees plus seasonals and interns. We are the largest private employer in Seward, the 11th largest private employer on the Kenai Peninsula, and we see about 160,000 visitors a year. We're open year-round. This seawater heat pump project, we've been discussing with several partners that have been involved in different ways and are interested in this, where this is going. The city of Seward for potential district heating, Kenai Fjords National Park on their buildings, the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery, which is just two lots down from us, and the Seward Marine Center of the university, which is next door to us. Both of those also have existing seawater intakes. Our goal for this project was to reduce our carbon footprint. The Sea Life Center uses a lot more power than most buildings of its size. We don't just have office space. We have a lot of pumps. We pump a lot of water, and that costs quite a bit. So we're 150,000 square feet. We have a variety of different types of heating, air handlers, as well as a hot water baseboard. We currently have two oil-fired boilers and one electric boiler. Our heating oil demand in the winter can be over 500 gallons a day, up to 132,000 per year. At the peak of the gas prices, our annual heating costs $463,000 in heating fuel. The idea of seawater heat is very strong in Scandinavia. Sweden and Norway both have several examples, which we've listed here, with district heating or heating with seawater of, for instance, the Statoil Research Center in Norway. Seward is the perfect location for this, not the only one in Alaska, but the Resurrection Bay stores a lot of solar heat. And that is available year-round. As you can see from this slide, the middle bar is the average monthly seawater temperature, and we've got the maximum and minimum between 2003 and 2008. There's a wide range. 2011 and 12 is going to be near the minimum. We're maybe possibly even below that minimum on that graph right now. The water is generally above 36 degrees, and that becomes a year-round heat resource for us. The Juneau Airport gave a very good introduction to heat pumps. We're basically running an air conditioner in reverse and using the heat that's in that water and reducing the temperature of the water and using that to increase the heat that we're using in the building. The coefficient of performance is a very important metric. You basically have to use electricity to run your heat pump. So you look at the amount of heat that is produced from the heat pump, divide that by the amount of power you put in to run the heat pump, and that's your COP, or coefficient of performance. The expected was 3.1 to 3.6. Running the entire system takes additional electricity, so your overall coefficient of performance will be less than that, but that is just the heat pumps. Here's another view of the technology. If you'd like to know more about this, we should probably talk offline. we have installed two heat pumps in our building. This is a picture of what they look like. They are much larger than a small refrigerator. They are taller than a person and quite sizable. This unit has automated controls, and we can actually watch what's going on with it through the internet, and we'll show you a screen that you can watch the controls a little later. skip that one. In terms of financials, the capital cost for this project, what's been installed so far, is about $833,000. We had two grants for this project, the first one from the Denali Commission and the second one from AEA. The Denali Commission was about two-thirds of that grant amount and AEA about one-third. Plus, we've put in some of our own funding, especially with staff time. A lot of this was self-installed. There are some additional costs due to the heat pump system with pumping the glycol, just running the heat pumps, regular operations and maintenance. But the amount of heating oil saved, you can see $212,000 of heating oil saved a year was our initial prediction. And so this we're estimating on an annual basis we'd save over $100,000 a year net of the additional costs. 6.7-year payback was the initial estimate, and annually avoiding CO2 production at 1.3 million pounds. And these are all, numbers are all done at today's fuel oil prices, 3.69. This is a screen that we can use in real time to watch what is going on with the heat pumps. You can see kind of in the middle up to the top, the two heat pumps both claim they are running at this period of time. And you can see the temperatures in and out at each different loop. I understand it's a complex slide, but it's something that we can watch in real time and see what's going on. This slide was from January 21st. It was 6 degrees outside. This has been a cold winter in Seward. Pretty good wind going on. And I mentioned the coefficient of performance before. The total output over the total input, which at this specific point in time was 2.58. So that means for every 1 unit of electricity we put in, we get 2.58 units out. There's some calculations that go into this in terms of exactly how much goes in, how much goes out, and looking at the difference in temperature that and the flows, we can calculate those numbers. The important part is in the upper right, the amount of savings. As of this point in time, we were saving 11.5 gallons of fuel per hour by using these pumps. And that's based just on the pumps, not on measuring anything happening on the outside, so we know that this is happening. That's 275 gallons a day at today's fuel prices, about $1,000 a fuel a day. Subtracting off the electric that we are additionally paying, the 372, gives us a net savings of $643 a day. Now, this savings will change throughout the year. We'll be able to measure this on an instantaneous basis and record that and be able to measure over the course of time. We did an analysis of, we actually didn't use any fuel in the building this winter until December 21st. We completely ran on the heat pumps. We're currently running on a mixture of the two, which is a better way of measuring the impact. Just so you can see, here's a couple pictures of the heat pumps. They were retrofitted into our building in the basement. This is one of the heat exchangers. There are multiple heat exchangers in this system. This is the one where the seawater runs in one side of this heat exchanger and a glycol loop goes in the other side and picks up the heat from the seawater. These are some of the circulation pumps that are moving the water throughout the building. This, because it was a retrofit, goes quite a distance through our building just in order to be where our seawater comes into our building is at the opposite end is where the heat pumps are. You probably wouldn't do that if you were not retrofitting. This is a heat exchanger. We are sending the heat right now both to our domestic hot water as a preheat as well as to our air handlers. And this is the heat exchanger to the air handlers. Right now the air handlers probably are using about two-thirds of our capacity to be heating the air. This is a domestic hot water heat exchanger. We're preheating the domestic hot water up to about 90, 92 degrees, and then it goes to the electric boiler to get up to the top temperature. Motor control center, that can the brains behind these units. And then in terms of using this in Alaska, this is would be relevant in coastal communities with ice-free seawater. There are some heat pumps. very similar to these. They're installed in the NOAA facility at Lena Point. So this area also works. The seawater temperature does not fluctuate as much, so it'll be interesting to compare what they have seen versus what we've seen throughout the year. One of the biggest challenges is you need a large seawater intake for this project. We also have a seawater intake because we need it for our animal systems, as does the Lena Point facility. So it makes a lot of sense when you have an existing seawater intake. And the potential benefits, as you've seen, we're predicting over $100,000 per year in energy savings on this. Of course, it would be reduce more carbon if you were on, with a hydroelectric sort of electricity system, which we are not. Just in terms of the timeline, the design was completed in 2010. We installed the heat pumps and the major equipment last spring. The heat pumps started operating in July. Now, you'll notice the commissioning and startup phase goes through this coming February. It is not completed. So we are still working on tying all the systems together and getting the system fully commissioned. Those screens that you saw that have the instantaneous temperatures and flows were enabled in August. We are still having challenges with getting that system to hook into the heat pumps. That system is designed for these heat pumps to run as air conditioning units. So the companies are having some challenges, and the programmers are still working on that. Our real season of data testing is this winter. And so as every week goes by, we're learning more and more about how this is actually going to work. One additional thing that we have, funding that we secured recently, was from the Murdoch Foundation, about $183,000, I believe, to connect this existing seawater heat pump system to our slab heat system. There's additional capacity in the heat pumps, so we'll be able to hook our slab heat into this as well for next winter. So we'll have a complete winter without that before we transition to that. We'll also be connecting some heat recovery, so waste heat in the building from electrical rooms, computer rooms. We'll be able to pull that heat out of those rooms and put it back into our heating system. The heat recovery system has a payback of less than 3 years just itself. And we'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Feige and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed on this design, you're using glycol as the heat transfer fluid. The airport's project, they're using a water methanol mix. What are the advantages or disadvantages of what you're doing?
This is Darrell Schaefermeyer. We use propylene glycol because of the environmental requirements. We have a very environmentally sensitive facility, and it's a pretty safe material to use. It's basically vegetable grade. Mm-hmm. It's not going to harm animals or anything like that. So specifically, that's why we use the propylene glycol rather than some other alternative transfer fluids.
Just a little more expensive, that's all.
It is, yes.
And then follow up,
Representative Feige.
The overall system operator screen where you're showing the system operating, it looks like you got taken a seawater intake temperature of 40 Fahrenheit. How much does that temperature vary, and can you adjust where you pull the seawater from outside? And at certain times of the year, it's better to pull in colder water versus warmer water. Is there any way to adjust it? Is that not feasible?
It's really not. We have a fixed seawater intake system. Okay. In our case, our seawater intake is at 275 feet deep. Goes out a pipeline that's 750 feet long. It's a 24-inch pipeline. We have two pipelines that length. It's siphoned into a large wet well, and from there we have vertical turbine pumps that then pump it throughout the building to the various tanks and uses. We have one dedicated 20 horsepower pump in that wet well that supplies the seawater for the heat pump system, and it depending upon the demand, whether we have two heat pumps running or one, it's anywhere from 350 up to 700 gallons per minute that it supplies. And so it's fixed. It's whatever the temperature is in the bay at that time is what we're able to receive and work with.
At 200-something feet?
275 feet.
Down below the surface, yes, does the temperature vary all that much?
Probably not a whole lot in our case because of the nature. We're on a deep fjord bay. We have a lot of upwelling and current change and transfer, which makes this a real ideal location for this type of system.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where your seawater intake is, some of the systems like this have had some trouble at the intake area, and I see that it's ice-free, you need ice-free water, but some of them have had trouble through the screens because that they get plugged with other debris. And can you explain those challenges and how you've overcome
them? Indeed, we have that challenge. the legislature, you folks, funded a project for us a couple of years ago to help us with that problem. We discovered we had some pretty significant biofouling in our two intake lines, and you provided funding, and we were able to put in a pigging system on one of the pipelines and clean that pipeline, and we're now able to do it annually to through that system to keep it clean. So that is indeed something that you have to be mindful of. We also have periods when we experience silt in the water, so in our system we had to design a special filter device that would take that out so it wouldn't plug up the heat exchangers. And so you have to design in those kinds of contingencies depending upon your source and supply of water. But biofouling is a pretty common thing you have to deal with in salt water.
Yeah, follow up, Representative Wilson.
So you feel like you've kind of got that taken care of and it's running smoothly and everything now?
Yes, absolutely.
Good.
Yeah. And I think in a previous presentation, it was pointed out that Seward is ideally located in one respect because they said, yeah, they've got these pipes down there and they siphon into the building. So they're not having, if the building was located high above, then you're going to have to pump the water up to the facility there or locate remotely your heat pump stuff lower down. And so that's another thing that probably works to enhance the efficiency of the system, isn't it?
Yes, Reverend Seen. If you go out to the Out Cape facility, one of their challenges is they're built up on Lena Point and they're a long way from the water. They siphon it into the beach and then they've got a big tank and they have to pump it quite a ways uphill to get it up to their facility. So they have that challenge with their pumping costs. We also, of course, have to pump it around our building, and that's pretty costly. We have a pump from 40 horse to 25 horse to 15 horse that do that. So that's a cost factor that you have to have just moving the water.
With your first question, Representative Gardner.
Just a quickie, do you know where the pumps and the exchanges are made?
In the United States, in our case, we tried to be careful there and made sure that equipment. Now, since we acquired the heat exchange or the heat pumps, the company that manufactured those has been now purchased by a foreign country. So that's just changed since occurred since we purchased the pumps. So but we tried to go all U.S. Manufactured.
Thank you.
I have to make one correction to that. The steel pipe that we used, we had to put in a lot of steel piping. That's manufactured in Korea. It's just really one of the options. We have very few options there in this country now for steel pipe.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for coming in and presenting. Our next presenter on renewable energy projects will be NACNAC Electric. Oh, and for the committee's information, Peter Crimp with the Alaska Energy Authority is online for questions if anyone has any questions for AEA as we go forward. Thank you. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I really appreciate the opportunity for a small area of Alaska to be heard today, and I really do appreciate your time with this. I'm Nancy Morris-Lyon, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors for Naknek Electric Association, and I have been for several years now, and I've been quite involved in this project. So with that being said, I'm really encouraged to hear the good news from both the Juneau Airport and the Seward Sea Life Center. I congratulate them on successful geothermal experiences, and I'm glad to see all of their rewards that they're getting from it financially. And I wish that I had that good of news to share with you here today for ourselves, because believe me, myself as well as pretty much everybody who lives out in the Bristol Bay Borough and many of the processors and everybody else would like to see this project go forward and be completed and enjoy some of those cost savings as well. Right now we're at a bit of an impasse, and basically I apologize also for not having a pre-prepared slide presentation for you, but hopefully between the message, the information I provide and the message you have in front of you, you'll be able to glean where we're at and where we hope to be headed in the very near future. Basically, right now where we're at is, as you know, we've had to been forced to file bankruptcy. We were required in our original well to do balanced drilling as opposed to geothermal drilling, which required us to use material called barite in there that basically stopped up the hole that we developed, and we are unable to assess the resource that we have down there right now.
Could you back up and explain to the committee balanced drilling versus geothermal drilling?
Balanced drilling is something that's found more, and again, I am not a geothermal expert or a drilling expert. I'm just a member of the board of directors. So in layman's terms to me, as I understand it, balanced drilling is what's required in when you're trying to do oil and gas production. You're required to put mud in the hole in order to drill rather than using air pressure. And the mud placed in the hole can, what we're looking for is the openings and fissures in the ground to produce the heat and water flow that we're hoping for. When that mud settles in those, it doesn't allow any of that to come through. For what the earth has to offer us, coming out and up the hole is stopped. Okay, so that's basically where we're at right now. We've got a hole that, and the state of Alaska required us to drill in this manner. And because of that, we've used this material that we've tried to flush it out. We've been unsuccessful in doing so. So, which brings us to step two here. In the very recently, in the last few months, the Department of Energy, the Federal Department of Energy, Roy Mink, who's with U.S. Geothermal, who was our hired expert, is quite nationally known. Geothermex, who is also very well known in the geothermal industry, have sat down together. We're very glad that they've done this, and they've talked about our project, they've researched and analyzed the information that we have for them, and they have decided that the best possible reasoning for us to do is going to be a side drill of our current hole. It's the most cost-effective approach that we have available to us right now in their estimation, and we actually agree with it. We think that that's correct. The barite's not coming out of there. The hole that we have is not usable as it is right now, and we are unable to assess our resource because of that. So we've got to be able to sidetrack drill, which is basically the drill that's recommended is a 5,000-foot drill off of the current hole. Okay. Another reason that this is being recommended is we're set up to move forward, and we have about 70% of the materials we need on site right now. So if we went with this method, it would only cost us approximately $3.2 million. We could start it as soon as the first barge came in. We would be able to get the sidetrack in. It would take, there's some time that it would still take once we got the sidetrack done. We'd still need about probably 4 weeks of testing with Geothermex, and then we would find out exactly where our assessment was at with the drill. So that's our hope right now. That's where we're trying to take it. We're on a very, very tight time frame. We have limited access to some of the Department of Energy's funds. A lot of people are really giving us strong support in this. And we still have access to a lot of the federal funds that were granted to us. I'm sure that that's going to be on a tight time frame, too, because DOE is looking for funds that haven't been used and trying to gather them back up and replace them with other operations that they think might be able to use them. However, they do still see us viable. They're giving us every chance possible to try and make these funds be put to use with our project. Our project is truly ready to roll, other than the $3.2 million, as I said. If we can procure that money, we have our loan package already into the rural utility services to move forward with that, and Department of Energy has agreed that those funds that they have already guaranteed us will be made readily available for us to continue forward with our future holes and geothermal enhancement, which is what we've said from the very beginning we will need in order to make this operation work. So we feel like, you know, we've done our best to we're a community of less than 1,000 people. We have put in, of our own money, $23 million into this project. We spend, as a community of less than 1,000 people, $5.7 million in fuel this past year. At current prices, if prices don't go up, if we could be so lucky, we'll have $24.5 million in fuel costs in the next 5 years. $23 million we put in. We're looking for 3.2 in order to do the sidetrack so we can assess if this project will work and be viable. And we have support. We have support from BB&A, from BB&C. We have Bristol Bay, as I'm sure all of you know, is the world's leading sockeye capital. Of all those sockeye salmon going into Bristol Bay, there's 95% of them go through our dock, our area. We are the hub and the economic engine for Bristol Bay. Everybody who's looking at growing or developing out there is turning to us saying, are you going to be able to put geothermal energy online for us? We need this. We want affordable, reliable energy so that we know we have a future to build on in your area. And so in a nutshell, we are struggling right now. The bankruptcy court has also been extremely friendly to us. They've basically given us an extension, but we're on a tight time frame. We have about 30 days left to find the $3.2 million. Get this sidetrack done. If we, you know, if we have a commitment to the money, then we can go ahead with the sidetrack and they will hold off for us. If not, they'll basically tell us that we need to go to a diesel-only plan and begin selling off the drilling equipment, which will basically make us, the project will be over at that point, because obviously in order for us to come up with another $23 million to put it together, it's not going to happen, at least not in the near future. So basically, I guess I'm just here to glean any support that we can from any and all of you, to know that we've got a lot invested, that we need a little bit more in order to make this happen so that we can truly assess what we have out there. I think that there's a lot of value that even the state of Alaska can glean from any information that we can get from this sidetrack. Everybody's looking at geothermal as a possible resource for the future. $3.2 million in reality is a drop in the bucket compared to what's been spent in a lot of other areas when we've already got $23 million on the table for it. It would give you a lot of information on what the potential is in the whole area out there if we could get this sidetrack done. And that's kind of where we're coming from.
Okay, well, thank you. And before we go to questions, I just want to say that I know it's difficult to come when you're not reporting success and you're coming before a committee of the legislature saying things haven't worked, and we'll hope for better success here in the future. And so we have Representative Feige and then Representative Heron and Kawasaki.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the bottom of page one, you're talking about the drilling of the G1 hole. And I guess the first thing is the temperature. You expected it to be 350 degrees and it's 290?
It has, you know, the testing has varied. Part of the these temperatures, the temperature tools do not work well in this barite solution. So most of our temperatures have come from the people who drilled the hole. The mud people have to have temperature estimates in order to know what kind of mixture of mud they need to put down there next. Mm-hmm. And so most of these well log temperatures are actually gleaned. The ones we feel are more reliable are gleaned from that. And there is a variable of temperatures, but we've also gone through a variable of fracturing systems as we work our way down through the hole.
Okay, and then the second question is, what should the, there's a natural gradient in temperature as you go deeper into the earth, the temperature gradually rises. How much different than the normal temperature gradient is 290 degrees?
I have to look for an expert. I don't know that. Yeah, I'm not being a geothermal expert. I can't help you with that, in all honesty. Okay. Wish that I could.
And then apparently you lost the first, you lost the original hole. You drilled a sidetrack. I assume you lost that. You drilled the second one. Bottom hole apparatus got stuck, and then pretty much you were done with that hole.
Well,
sounds like some fairly challenging drilling conditions just geologically.
There were some challenging drilling conditions going on, but we only had the one. Donna, would you care to join me up here? I can have Donna Vukic, because she has a little bit more of the technical aspects down, being day-to-day on it.
And would you identify yourself on the record so we get that in, who you represent?
Yes, Donna Vukic with Naknek Electric Association. And we did have challenges. We, in the original hole, at about 11,300 feet, the cones came off of a bit we were using. And there's been a lot of discussion on why and how that happened. But we weren't able to resolve that. The first sidetrack, when the contractor that we were using went in, they went back into the original hole. That was a malfunction, and we did not pay that cost of that sidetrack. That was an error on their part. The second sidetrack was open too many days, I believe. That's really where we started running into problems. The longer the hole is open, the more instability problems that you run into.
Okay, and my ultimate question here is what leads you to believe that you're going to have success with a third sidetrack?
Well, we will be utilizing a different engineer on it. We know exactly what we're going into, which we didn't, obviously, at the original hole in the beginning. And using the technical team with the U.S. Department of Energy will be on site with us.
Yeah. Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I knew very little of this project other than in the news. So I've read your backup here. And so I guess I got three questions, Mr. Chairman. But is it, just by looking here, the way I read it is, past state general fund dollars is $1.25 million?
Correct.
And so the rest of the project costs have been borne by you or other, like federal grants or federal loans?
Right. So far it was with loans is how it's been done. And the 1.25 is not part of the $23 million. The 1.25 was to try to clean out the barite drilling fluid from the well, which was unsuccessful. We actually used more of our own money doing that also. And the amount of drilling fluid we were able to bring out was minimal, and we had to look at whether this was a cost-effective way or not, which it was not.
Yeah. Obviously, the chairman has already said that this is, and you explained it, this is a difficult situation that you're in right now. So I guess by looking at this late March deadline, March 22, it says, or late March, is, of course, the legislature won't get out of here till April 15th. The governor will take time to decide if he's going to allow any funding to go through. So if the 3.2 was put in the budget, the court is going to take that into consideration?
I believe that we will need to have a firmly obligated $3.2 million in order to
have the court take that into consideration.
Okay, well, I guess, yeah. Well, the legislative process, there's probably an opportunity to do that. But I guess if that all worked out, the $3.2 million, is that enough to actually confirm the resource?
We have about 70% of the material on hand to be able to do the sidetrack. It's about 45 days of on the long end of drilling that 5,000 foot off, and about 4 weeks after that for the actual testing by geothermic.
One final question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harris.
Yes. Three entities, Governor's Office, DNR, and Alaska Energy Authority. What is their position on your $3.2 million request and the project as a whole?
We have not had any support from the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. What is the balance on your debt? Is it $23 million or is it something less than that?
Our total debt is on the fourth page, which shows about $44.5 million. That includes our fuel loans. That includes our existing diesel generation plant loan and our drilling rig, long-term debt, along with the debt on the well itself.
Okay. If I can follow up question. And then under the bankruptcy steps that were taken, there was a recommended rate increase of 9 cents. What does that bring your total rate? And how under that rate, how long would it take to pay this debt off?
Well, we the bankruptcy court, the reorganization plan for diesel only would be a little bit different than that total debt. Just so you know, the 9 cent increase was done to pick up debt load, and our total rates to our members is approximately 49 cents a kilowatt hour.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Representative Feige.
It seems to me just the timing and our ability to get any funding to you is somewhat hampered to do it in a timely fashion, but have you approached other entities in the Naknek area, like the Bristol Bay Borough or some of the ocean, you know, the seafood processors and, you know, folks that would benefit by success in this project? Have you talked to them about perhaps raising some financing?
We have, and the problem is we cannot take any more loans on. The bankruptcy court obviously will not allow that, so it can't be that. We have requested grants from the Native corporations, and Bristol Bay Borough is in the middle of their dock. There's funding, not any funding available for that. We have gone to our processors who said, well, we stayed on your power, even though the rates are so high, and we believe we're putting ours into it at that rate. So you see it's...
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming and updating on the situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope next year I can come back and give a more positive report.
Thank you.
Look at that number.
And let's see, we now have Kodiak Island Pillar Mountain Wind. And just so everybody's aware, we have, you know, there's a meeting in here following ours. So we have Kodiak Electric, we have Siri Fire Island Wind Update, Ocean Renewable Power, and possibly ATNA if they call it. So we should move along. Thank you. Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Hi, yes. My name is Darren Scott. I'm the President and CEO of Kodiak Electric Association. We're a local electric cooperative for Kodiak, Alaska.
I'm going to talk to you a little bit today about the Kodiak Pillar Mountain Wind Project that was installed a few years back. First, I wanted to go after really what started these type of projects for us in Kodiak. We've got a vision in our community set by our board of directors, being a locally owned cooperative, to produce basically 95% of our power with cost-effective renewable energy. And another way to say that is diesel really can't be a big part of our future. And that's the goal we've been driving on. We've been driving on it for several years. And this project we're going to talk to you all about here in a little bit is a big step in that direction. It hasn't quite gotten us there, but it was a step in the direction to finally get us there. First, a little bit about KEA. Again, we're a locally owned cooperative. We serve community of Kodiak, village of Port Lyons, also the areas of Chiniac and Sagjack. We've got about 5,800 meters. We're an isolated electrical grid. We're not connected to anyone else. Our peak loads are about 26 megawatts, so we're kind of a mid-range size for the state. And our minimum load is 11 megawatts, and that kind of comes into more into play when you're dealing with wind energy and the way it works. We've got the backbone of our system, which is two hydro units, run around 22 megawatts total, Terror Lake Hydroelectric Plant, and we're working on actually adding a third unit to that now. And the Pillar Mountain Wind Project, again, that's been installed a couple years ago, three GE 1.5 megawatt units, total of 4.5 megawatts there. And we've got a large range of diesel units and combined cycle unit, all diesel-fired, run about 33 megawatts, and that provides us peaking power as well as backup for our hydro facility when it's down. On the wind project, it began operation July 2009, and it's been operating great. It's good to be able to come before you today and talk to you about that and in a lot of ways say thanks for the support, and I've got some slides of the support you all have given us to help this come to fruition. From that, we've generated over 32 million kilowatt hours since its inception, and it's beating our expectations as we've gone forward, and that's a large portion of our production on an annual basis. We have about 80% of our power comes from Terror Lake, so we've got 80% hydro to start with, and we were going after that other 20% to basically try to make our goal. This wind project here pushes around 8 to 9%, depending on the year and how much fish processing we've got and those type of things. And again, it's been very successful, pushing a little over 12 million kilowatt hours a year so far. On the financing, and got $5 million from the state process. Again, we started this process back in 2005, studying the facility and the project. We were successful through the Renewable Energy Fund Round 1, $4 million, and also a general appropriation grant as well. And we thank you for that. We also have quite a bit of our own money in this project as well. We were successful. There's a federal program for cooperatives such as ours to get low-interest financing for renewable projects. And we've got a $12 million loan for this, running at about 0.85% interest. So it was a very attractive loan there, and that helps out quite a bit. And the remaining dollars we finance directly from KEA proceeds. So we've got $16.6 million into this project, but again, thank you very much for the $5 million. It's helped the project greatly. As I said before, operational successes. As a power company, one of the main things you get into, obviously, is reliability. And with wind, that was definitely a question going into it. Wind power is very different than anything we had dealt with before. Hydro, diesel, you say you want X amount of megawatts, it gives you X amount of megawatts. Wind just does what it wants to an extent. We have some control on the bottom end, but on the top end, they go with the wind, basically. So, but with that, we did quite a bit of work on our system beforehand to get prepared for wind. We did work on our hydro facility, did work on our distribution grid. And that's been very successful. We also do some curtailing on the wind. It doesn't go at 100% all the time. We have to back it off at times if the wind's too variable. But we do that in order to keep the lights on. And we had that plan when we did the economic analysis to begin with, and it's gone quite well. From a maintenance perspective, the GE units have been as advertised as well. They were predicting they were saying 98%, but their literature said 95% availability, and we have been approaching 98% availability since they came online. And availability means basically that they are available to operate 98% of the time, so 2% of the time they're down for routine maintenance or other maintenance issues we might be getting into. We do have to take them down twice a year for significant maintenance checks, make sure everything's working properly through that process, so that counts into that 2%. And finally, we spent quite a bit of time beforehand studying avian areas. And there is some eagle usage in the area, but we have not. We did pre-studies, we've done post-studies, and the eagles notice these, and they fly away from them. And from that, we've not had any bird strikes in the 2.5 years that these have been in operation. But one of the largest successes we've had through this really is it comes down to the fuel savings and the savings back to our members in Kodiak. We saved with that 32 million kilowatt hour, we saved a little over 2.2 million gallons of fuel since they've been in operation. And a net savings, assuming $3.25 a gallon, and over those 2.5 years, fuel's jumped all over the place. But assuming that $3.25 a gallon, the net savings back to our community has been $4.8 million. And how we work that and how we calculate it is we charge ourselves 12 cents a kilowatt hour for the wind power. And then we pass on all the other savings directly through our cost of power adjustment, which is basically a fuel charge, straight to the members. So if we had to generate that 32 million kilowatt hours with diesel, you're at 26, 27 cents a kilowatt hour. We're just charging 12 cents to our members. That covers all our debt, depreciation, maintenance, everything with it. And that 12 cents, the savings from that, the diesel would cost above and beyond, net for the community is $4.8 million over these last 2.5 years. So taking it back to some earlier comments, from a time-saving standpoint, for the investment from the state at $5 million, we're really just about there. And these numbers from a few weeks ago, so probably around today, we've basically broken even from the original investment from the state. And we're taking this and we're building on that success. So you'll see another project moving forward, a little bit different type of wind project. It's the Pillar Mountain High Penetration Wind Project. So you can faintly see in that picture, the early pictures had three wind turbines. We've ordered three more, moving forward on adding wind to the system. As I talked about earlier, that wind does move up and down quite a bit. The reason we stopped at three the first time is because our hydro facility could only keep up with three wind turbines moving up and down. We're adding a third turbine to the facility to help it keep up basically with the wind. And we're also completing the engineering and purchase on a battery energy storage system that will provide short, very short term, you know, in the seconds, less than a minute type power supply for us to build a bridge to give our hydro facility time to catch up. It needs about a minute, maybe a minute and a half, depending on the situation. This energy storage system will do that. We're actually looking at two of them combined, operating in parallel. But we're excited about what that's going to bring. We're on a fast-track timeline with that because we are excited about getting to 95%. Again, hydro's running around 80% with some efficiencies we're getting out of the third turbine. May push that to about 82, 83%. Again, the first wind project that we've talked about earlier, another 8%, 9%. With this additional project here, we'll be pushing, at least at today's usage rates, around that 98% time. We saw some decent load growth last year in Kodiak, which is wonderful. People are starting to switch to electricity, which is wonderful. It makes us a little nervous at the same time for electric heat, but we're excited about it. And this, again, will, for the short term, allow us to achieve our goals. The goal is set for 2020, so with the load growth, we'll have to work on some other things in the future. But over the next, by 2013, hopefully summer or fall 2013, this whole plan should be completed out, and we should be really reaping the benefits, basically doubling the benefits that we've seen out of the Pillar Mountain Wind Project from that. So, again, we really want to thank you all for the support, and it's been a great investment. And, again, the community is saving quite a bit of money on their energy, and it's been a great fit with the environment and with the community of Kodiak. It's not affected the Avon resources, and the air is cleaner to boot. So thank you very much.
Great, and thank you. And it's, you know, we're not into the budget, and next year what we're doing is assessing what we've helped fund in the past and finding out successes and everything. So Resources Committee is looking at that aspect. Although we all need to know the figures and proposals and those kind of things, so I just wanted to make it clear for the audience that we're not sitting as a finance committee. We're trying to assess the successes that we've had with moving towards renewable energy across the state in all these different projects. So, Representative Gardner had a question.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say I'm really glad that the NACNIC people didn't have to follow you. It's tough for them. Just a quick question again. Do you know where your turbines are manufactured?
They're General Electric turbines. The nacelles, the gearbox assemblies and such, were manufactured in Pensacola, Florida. The towers were made in Oklahoma. I can't remember the town. The blades in Brazil, and some of the electronics were in Canada and the U.S., so they're multi-conglomerate.
Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Have you heard any community concern over visual impacts of this form of technology?
No. One of the wonderful things about this, it's really been 100% win-win. You got, you know, I'd say maybe half's not the right word, excuse me, through the chair, but half the folks, let's really, you know, work on the environment, that standpoint, and the other half folks want, let's keep these rates down. Well, this accomplishes both. The only concerns I've heard, there were concerns or fears about avians, but that's been mitigated. And there's good berry picking up on the hill, and they didn't want us to take that away. But aesthetically, people have been very supportive of it, and people by and large think they look very good.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
And now we're going to go on to Siri, Fire Island Wind Project. Ethan Schutt, are you online? Oh, no, you're here. Yeah. Welcome. Sorry, I didn't see you in the back there.
That's Heidi.
All right, thank you very much for having us here today. In the interest of time, since there are others, I'll skip through really quickly, especially the sort of promotional stuff and overview stuff at the beginning.
Yeah, and would you introduce yourself to the record first?
So I'm Ethan Schutt. I'm the Senior Vice President of Land and Energy Development at SERI. So we'll skip through all those first slides. Just for overview, the Fire Island Wind Project is offshore from Anchorage, about 3 miles west of Anchorage International Airport. SERI is the surface owner of most of the island. The other in-holding blocks are federal tracts, FAA, and Coast Guard. So the overview map you have of the project are all the permitted turbine sites. There are 33 of them. This first phase that we're building, we'll be talking about, is 11 of them. They're the ones that run up from kind of the toe of the island on the southwestern tip of the island up through the middle. That string of 11 turbines are the ones that get built this phase. So it's a project we've been pursuing actually for about a decade with a variety of permitting and other development challenges. We are on track now for construction and first power by this fall of 2012. Our customer is Chugach Electric Association under a power purchase agreement for a 25-year fully flat fixed price term. We thank Chugach for all of their efforts on our behalf. Obviously, for any project, you have to have a customer. And for a renewable energy project that's new to an area, it actually entails a fair amount of work and cooperation from your customers, so we appreciate Chugach for that. Overview of the project, 11 of the General Electric 1.6 megawatt units. They're effectively the same units that you just saw in Kodiak, so we'll have nameplate of 17.6 megawatts. It's about almost 33% net capacity factor, which equates to about 51,000 megawatt hours per year. Given some rough efficiencies of the system, that's about a half of a BCF of avoided natural gas burn in our rail belt system. So we'll skip through this very quickly, but the RCA approved the cost recovery by Chugach in October. Contracts have been executed on all the major project components. The financial close with our lender CoBank was achieved on November 30th, and we are currently building the transmission line, which is the point where we thank the state of Alaska for its investment in this project. The state several years ago made a $25 million appropriation in support of the transmission line. So that transmission line is a 12.5-mile 34.5 kilovolt double circuit transmission line, about 3 to 3.5 miles, depending on how you measure it, of offshore, and the rest is onshore. Because this project has a lot of economic impact locally, you should know that the land-based construction contract for this power line is a local contractor, Northern Power Line. and the marine portion is Cruise Companies, which is also a local company based in Palmer. Most of the equipment is manufactured, or the cabling equipment is manufactured somewhere else because we don't have those facilities here in Alaska. And at the end, when the project is built, Chugach will own and maintain the line. So we're building it and handing it over to them. Cost overruns and those sorts of risks are on us. Balance of plant construction on the island is Delaney, which is a Tetra Tech company. It's also the company that built the first phase of Kodiak's project. There are significant subcontracts with local contractors involved in that. Project schedule, in 11, we executed the commercial contracts, closed the project financing, and initiated the transmission line construction. Now in 2012, we will continue transmission line construction. About mid-March, major components for the turbines will start to show up. And then when the ice goes out in the inlet, we'll begin the logistics for getting turbine components onto the island and major construction activities on the island. We'll be done with turbine erection August, September. First commercial power is anticipated about late September. So this project and everything it entails supports a lot of the energy objectives of the state of Alaska: private investment, locally owned and operated, local job creation, local contracting opportunity, energy supply diversification, long-term energy price stability, and environmentally responsible project. So I can pause really briefly and answer questions about that one, then I'll run very, very quickly through this other project that's not a truly renewable but is an alternative energy technology. So,
sure. Are there questions? Representative Harris.
Yeah, thanks for that's outstanding project. And, of course, in one of the slides, you said you've come to terms with Chugach for 25 years. But what is the expected life of the entire project?
The turbine manufacturers give a turbine life of 25 years. Most of the components of the turbine itself, the foundations, the electrical systems, the towers, the physical towers, have much longer life than that. At the end of 25 years, there's a possibility that the technology will have evolved, that you can replace the nacelle and the power generating components at the top with something newer and more modern and reutilize the rest of the physical assets for another phase of the same project. So I think we have commercial finance for ours, so we have to convince our bank that the project life for the turbine components matches the project life for the loan. So that involves GE and outside consultants agreeing that is true.
Just one
follow-up
short question. Well, Ethan, is that, yeah, obviously in series long range, you anticipate that this Fire Island site, regardless of changing technologies, but in theory this is going to be many, many decades, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ethan. Go ahead with the
second piece. I'll run briefly through this project, the Stonehorn Ridge Underground Coal Gasification Project. It's a project we've been working on for several years, series project proponent. We have a partner for this, Loris Energy, which is a Houston-based UCG technology company. This is a project that's been carried entirely by Ceres Equity and has no public support at this point. UCG is an emerging energy technology that's been proven several places around the world, actually has a long history in the former Soviet Union, and is being pursued aggressively in places like Pakistan, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. It is a technology where you convert coal in situ, which means in place, into syngas, and then you produce the syngas at the surface and make beneficial use of it.
Sure.
Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, just really quick. The first statement says that UCG is a proven technology, and the last bullet says it's an emerging technology. Can you explain? I mean, you kind of went over some of the other countries
right.
that have, I mean, how how proven is it? And is there any other state that has done it?
So it's proven in the sense that it has been deployed at a commercial scale in several places, including about 15 times in the former Soviet Union. So it has been studied by national laboratories within the U.S., like the Lawrence Livermore National Lab and other arms of the Department of Energy. There's been a lot of study in Australia by the government of Queensland, and it's been commercially deployed at a kind of a pilot commercial scale by the national utility in South Africa, Eskom, as we sit here today. Now, I say it's also an emerging energy technology in the sense that there have not been a lot of commercial deployments of this technology in Western countries. So there are some in the development phase, but there are not a lot that have been commercially developed at this point. So ours would be one of the early pushes at commercial deployment in the United States.
Representative Dick?
Yes, quick question to clarify for me. Last year, I believe the Alaska State Legislature put up $500,000 for the testing of coal for the acelergy process. Is there any relationship between what you're doing and that, and have you looked into that? Acelergy, I believe, is a subsidiary of Exxon.
I didn't track what you did with the Acelergy appropriation, so I'm not sure exactly what that is. I can tell you that there's no relationship between that technology or firm and what we're doing.
Great, Ethan. Thank you.
So the Cook Inlet is actually a massive coal basin. Most of it's deeply buried. Most of it's wet. And so the access to that energy resource really depends on this technology. We have done a lot of work in the field. We've done a core drilling program that's confirmed significant volumes at commercial scale for this technology. We've validated favorable geology. We are at a tidewater location, and there is a local market need for some diversification. So we believe this project is consistent with the needs of South Central and its energy future. Synthesis gas, the product that comes out of the ground once it's cleaned up, and easiest thing to do is make it into electricity by combusting it through a turbine or a steam boiler. It can also be fairly easily upgraded through a process called methanation into methane, chemically CH4, which is referred to as synthetic natural gas if it's manufactured. And then it is also a good feedstock for liquid fuels, fertilizer, and other petrochemical products. Quick overview of where the area is north of the Beluga River. It's about 40 miles west of Anchorage. Project history, we drilled 13 core holes, did wireline data, used all of that to create a model of the site. We did also commission and receive a concept level engineering and costing study. And then as of today, if nothing went wrong, we completed a shallow high resolution 2D seismic program to complement the historical data we had out of the core programs. We had 26 shot holes to run today on the last line, so I'm assuming that went well and we are done. So our next steps are to incorporate that seismic data into our site geology. Then we'll begin laying out a site characterization drilling program, which is closer spaced holes instrumented for permanent monitoring and process purposes. Initiate baseline environmental data collection and begin the serious permitting process for being able to initiate a commercial process. So that's the end of that.
Well, great
presentation.
Thank you for the update. It's a project that we've been following, and appreciate that. I don't see any questions on this project, so thank you very much for joining us, Ethan.
All right, thank you.
And now we'll go to Ocean Renewable Power. Uh, And I think at this time, do we have Athna online? We don't. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, Athna was looking at the geological for geothermal potential there, so I'm going to take that off our schedule so that we have the rest of the time today for ocean renewable power. We don't have anyone to testify, and we're just, and you have paperwork showing the areas that they've located those potential geothermals in your notebook. So we'll leave it at that for that. So we have the, it's always short time, but at least we've got 15 minutes. So would you go ahead with your presentation, introduce yourselves, and again, since we have two male voices, make sure that you mention at least your first name when somebody goes to speak when you change.
Yes. I'm Doug Johnson. I'm the Alaska Business Development Director for Ocean Renewable Power.
I'm Monty Worthington, the Director of Project Development for Ocean Renewable Power Company.
We're really happy to be here today. I want to first of all thank Chairman Seaton for the invitation and committee members for allowing us to be here and give you a quick update on what we're doing with ocean energy, particularly tidal energy in Alaska and Cook Inlet. So just a quick one about the company. We have presented before in front of the legislature. Our company was formed in 2004 as a new technology company to develop hydrokinetic technologies in the marine environment, specifically tidal energy, marine currents, and as well as now we're looking at river energy environments. The company's based in Maine. In 2006, I helped found the company here in Alaska. The reason we're here is because of the tremendous resource that we have here in Alaska. Since our founding, we've grown. We've currently up to 28 employees now, and with our main, again, our offices are in Maine and Alaska, and we're currently doing projects as well in Nova Scotia, operating on the both sides of the Bay of Fundy, the American side and the Canadian side. To be, give you an update, really to be fair here, the key thing we're here today is talk about our progress. And really, to date, most of our progress has happened on the East Coast. One of the most robust tidal environments in the world, as you all well know, is the Bay of Fundy. We're currently moving forward for our first commercial project in the Bay of Fundy. We'll be grid-connected and delivering energy to the Bangor Hydro that late this spring. We've been moving along with our permitting process with FERC, and if everything goes well, we'll have our FERC permit in hand in February. So things have been moving quite well there. We have a three-phase project laid out there. Each of those will subsequently develop. First, we've got the Copsquick Bay project, then we're going to do Kendall Head, and then we're going to move out into Western Passage. This is a tremendous opportunity for us in the American side of the Bay of Fundy, and just right across the line there in Nova Scotia, there's other opportunities we're going to be working with. One of the big stories about ocean energy in America is the economic impact associated with these projects. One of the things that we're excited about is not only do we harvest energy from the oceans, but we also put people to work in doing it. We've had a significant economic impact. This particular slide sort of talks about the partnering that we've had to do to be able to make these projects happen. We have to build an ecosystem for a nascent industry. And this is really the economic ecosystem that's starting to evolve around us, and it's quite significant, and we're really proud of that. We want to thank Chairman Seaton for coming out and actually seeing this project in its infancy, actually, when we were first generating power, and showing that the technology was viable. This is just some of the things that you can say to our credit, what we've actually accomplished right now. We've added more than 100 jobs statewide in Maine right now. We've grown our own company from 0 to 25 employees, and we've spent about $8 million in the economy locally there. And what we see happening here is basically over the next period, we're going to continue to expand. But we see a huge opportunity in job growth in Maine, 400 to 500 direct jobs, and perhaps up to $1 billion of direct investment in this industry as it starts to play out. But what I'm really here to talk about today and what we're here to talk about is how does this affect Alaska and why is it important to talk about it? Well, everything we're learning in Maine, we can apply to Alaska. And we've been very fortunate, and thank you to the state of Alaska for taking a position in our company. Last year we were successful in round four with a $2 million grant to Ocean Renewable Power to develop our Cook Inlet Tidal Energy Project, which we're moving forward with, and Monty will be giving an update on that in just a moment. But it really does take a tremendous amount of work on the front end, and what we're excited about in Alaska is that we have this information. We have the successes in Maine to build on. We're not just starting from scratch here. We do recognize Alaska is a different environment. We do recognize that it's a much more, I guess you could say, harsh environment, especially Cook Inlet. But having been born here and grown up here and operated in the inlet over the years, I can say that I think our technology's got what it's going to take to make it happen. So we're very excited about this opportunity and really, really want to focus on the projects here in Alaska now.
So, yeah, big reason we spoke – oh, this is Monty Worthington. Thanks, Paul. And a big reason why we started talking about Maine is really what we see unfolding in Alaska is sort of a parallel story that follows what we've done in Maine and hopefully catches up to it at some point in our vision. This is a map showing, you know, some of the businesses we started to work with in Alaska and, as Doug said, create that ecosystem that supports the industry that we are. We're not here to do everything. We're here to figure out who locally can really help us to do what we want to do. And it's grown significantly in the last couple of years. You see there's, you know, probably on the order of 30-plus businesses now we've worked with in Alaska and done our first in-water deployments and tests in Nikiski this year, worked with a lot of the local contractors down there with really big success. And we look forward to seeing this map grow and populate like we have in Maine. Just giving a quick update on where we are. We are now pursuing our pilot project in Cook Inlet at the East Foreland. It's really an ideal site for doing a pilot project, mainly because as we looked at the inlet, this was the area we found that had the robust current resource very close to shore, and very close to shore in a place that has significant transmission infrastructure already in place. So we can do a demonstration project here, the 600-kilowatt demonstration project, without significant upgrades to the existing electrical system, which would really burden a small project. So we can basically hook in pretty much to what exists there once we get our power to shore. And that's a big step there. This is also one of the highest energy areas in the inlet, and that really helps us to be working in a higher energy area. This is how we'll be taking a step up from our main project and working in a higher energy environment. Of course, we'll have silt and things to deal with, but we did a lot of field work this last summer. We were working on completing a bathymetry and a current survey. Early ice season this year didn't allow us to not complete our projects. We'll be starting that up again in the spring. And with that data, we'll really have what we need in hand to fully lay out our project and complete our licensing process with FERC. So that is where we're at. There's also an image of the device there.
Now, Monty, this says 4 TideGen devices. Now, is this one TideGen device that's pictured on the slide, or is that 4?
That's 1. Yeah, so there'll be 4 of those.
Going to be for 600 kilowatts, there'll be a sequence of 4 units like this.
That's correct.
Okay, Thank you.
And then to speak a bit about the schedule, one of the things that happened in our schedules, initially we were hoping to get in the water in 2013. As Doug talked a bit about our main project, and our companies need to really focus on a success there before we get ahead of ourselves, we've decided to push back our installation at the Foreland to 2014, but to install our whole 600-kilowatt system in that year. And that's a reasonable goal, allows us to be prudent about moving forward in Alaska when we've proven our success in Maine, and also gives us the breathing room we need around collecting the data we didn't completely collect this summer and licensing our project on time. And what you see there is basically how we build from this 600-kilowatt demonstration phase up towards an eventual 5-megawatt or just under 5-megawatt pilot project. And this is in collaboration with HEA. We just signed a joint development agreement with them on this project, and the gist of this development agreement is for this demonstration phase to determine the cost of operating tidal energy in the inlet before we move forward with anything larger and see if this is indeed going to achieve a grid parity, if you will, competitive price with their current generation.
Yeah, Representative Dick had a question.
Yeah, quick question. I fly over that country all the time. I often tie down to Kiski, and I see the wake behind some of those rigs out there. I just know there's power to be had. But one concern I do have is I believe we've had, with 12 years of data, the environmental EPA went and extrapolated 300 years and said the beluga whales might be endangered. And so my question is, to what extent is that endangering what you might want to do, and which would be to all of our advantage?
Yeah. Well, one of the big reasons, besides all the logistical ones I talked about, we moved to the East Foreland, is in our conversation with NIMS, who's really our chief agency on the beluga issue. We started, you know, sort of adaptive management, if you will, and we started wanting to do a project up close to Anchorage, but NIMS basically said this is a highly sensitive area for the beluga. We'd rather see your pilot project, which you do support, start in a habitat that's less critical. This is still in critical habitat type 2, but it's seen as less high value than critical habitat type 1. And they want us to see or prove out our technology in a place that's not as wouldn't have as large an effect if there is one on the beluga. So we've done a lot of studies. We've had some funding from Department of Energy to look at how we monitor for belugas in this turbid environment and made a lot of progress. And we have what I see is a really working relationship with the agencies on this one. And I think that we will be able to continue to do our studies and deploy this in a prudent way. Monitoring is key. We have to monitor this project and show beyond the shadow of a doubt that we are not having an effect on belugas if we are going to have a presence in Cook Inlet. So that's a long answer there.
So basically one of the things that we wanted to bring in terms of reporting
today. Identify yourself again.
Oh, yes, sir. This is Doug Johnson, sorry. First of all, to acknowledge the fact that yesterday we did sign the joint development agreement with our partner, Homer Electric, which is a major milestone in the development of this project. Because, as Ethan reported from Siri's perspective, you know, when you're a developer, an independent power developer, you don't have a project unless you've got a customer, ultimately. So we're on the early stages of developing that relationship with potential customers, and we're very happy to have that partnership. Homer Electric's been really, really excellent to work with. In the Lower 48 and in Nova Scotia, they've approached this slightly differently. They've looked at ways to incentivize companies to come into the market, and they do this in a couple different ways. In Maine, what we've got there is through what they call a system benefit charge that they charge to all utilities, users actually of the utility. They put some money aside, and they've decided they're going to put out a bid for 5 megawatts of tidal energy, and they're going to pay a premium for that energy at 26 cents a kilowatt hour. And they're going to contract that for 20 years. And that's the way that they've gotten developers like ourselves interested in participating. And it's quite a nominal impact, about 3 cents per kilowatt hour or 15 cents a month on the average ratepayer. So it's not a big deal. In Nova Scotia, they were a little more aggressive. They started to look at this and they said, you know, we're out in the boonies here. We've got to look at this. And they've come up with a 65 cent, what they call feed-in tariff, or community feed-in tariff. That is quite remarkable. So we're working on a project there with that sort of incentive to get us going. Impact there a little bit less on the rate payers. But really, in essence, what these other areas have done is they've really said to themselves, look, we know there's economic benefit here. We've got to figure out how to incentivize industry to get in the game, and that's what they've done. In Alaska, we don't have anything like that yet, nor are we proposing anything like this. But we do need a way to be able to move forward. So when we look at our project moving forward, currently the state of Alaska has invested $2 million in this project, a 600 kilowatt demonstration project. To do this project fully, it's about a $13 million project. Ocean Renewable Power right now, we've got about $1.8 million committed to this project. And to finish up and move forward, we need about another $9.25 million to make this happen. This is good. What's interesting about this project and this budget is this is happening over a three-year period that really allows us to really understand what the operating and maintenance costs are associated with our turbines operating in the Cook Inlet environment. We'll have a lot of data from Maine, but it won't be definitive in what we need to operate in Alaska. So what we're looking for with this funding is to be able to run the project for 3 years and basically all in costs here, no impact to the ratepayers at Homer Electric as the electricity is connected to the grid and provided. And so we're going to be looking now for an appropriation to be able to fill that gap, that $9.25 million, here out of this legislative session. We have been also looking for opportunities for the company to continue to find ways that we can strengthen ourselves. So for us, the focus has been work with the Alaska Energy Authority, work with the Renewable Energy Fund, and now working with the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, which we are very excited to have coming online. And again, thank you for the foresight to see this coming, because we're a perfect match for that fund, and we're looking to see a way to perhaps attach this into that type environment or that type project. That funding source. So as we move forward now, we're focusing for the next short period here on Maine to get our success, grid connected, selling that energy into the Bangor Hydro grid this late spring. We believe that that will prove the commercial viability of our technology and be able to have a more favorable as we go into the next round of funding with the Renewable Energy Fund next year to be seen as a viable commercial technology. But we're sort of in this little timing gap, if you will, that we haven't proven the technology yet. And in this last round, our request was denied, and appropriately so. But it's just really more of a timing thing than anything. So that's why we're moving forward to keep the project alive. We're moving forward with the direct appropriation request.
I had a question just to clarify. So the 9.25 that you're talking about, is that for the full 5 megawatts?
600 is for the 600 kilowatt demonstration project for 3 years, all-in costs for 3 years of operation and maintenance as well.
Okay, that's not the whole development. That's the first phase.
Exactly, because what we really need to do here is we have to prove what is it really going to take to operate these devices in our environment in Alaska. We'll know what it's going to cost in Maine, but that's not Alaska. And quite frankly, what we're looking for here is trying to get as quickly as we can toward grid parity. What can we do to drive the cost of this electricity that's generated from the tides down? We know that right now it's going to be very expensive electricity, as you saw from the way that they're operating in Maine and they're operating in Nova Scotia with those incentives to get people in the game. You know, we're about 10 cent avoided cost here in Alaska, so we've got a long way to go to drive those costs down. And so what we're really looking at with this demonstration project is once we've run this for 3 years, we'll have a real sense of what the costs are. We won't be coming here with some spreadsheet that says, oh yeah, we think this is what it's going to be. We will know what it's going to be. And at that point, with our partner Homer Electric, we'll make the decision of moving forward with what we call a pilot project, because under our FERC license, we'll be able to build out to 5 megawatts at the Forelands.
Thank you. Questions for Ocean Renewable Power? Any? We sure appreciate you coming forward and giving us an update and presentation. And if there is nothing further from the committee, we will be adjourned at 3 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.